Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Today I want to share with you a dialogue that I had with Alex O'Connor, the cosmic skeptic. We had it several months ago down in Houston. I was invited to do a dialogue with him on the question of why I'm Christian and why he's not Christian. Hopefully that will be uploaded soon to the Capturing Christianity YouTube channel. But while I was down there, he and I recorded a private dialogue at his hotel, actually, on an ethical question. What can we kill? The ethics of killing. So we talk about animals, talk about euthanasia, we talk about abortion, and we also talk about just why human life is valuable at all, and does that require a theological explanation? So very good conversation, but before I get to it though, I want to ask a favor of you guys. Can you pray for me? You know, I just come to think of it, I don't really ask you guys to pray for the podcast, and that's not good. I should, you know, the prayers of righteous people are powerful, James 5:16. You guys are solid people. If you could pray for me, I would appreciate it because I feel kind of attacked recently technologically. Like my debate with Jacob Imam, my camera just completely malfunctioned right before the debate started. And so I had to use a backup on my laptop and the microphone didn't work. So that was weird. I made that rebuttal with Gavin Ortland and the file crashed, strangely enough, and I lost all that data. And then now I got the footage back from Alex of the dialogue we did, and the video was unusable. The audio survived, thankfully, but the video was unusable. So I don't think that's a coincidence. I feel like I'm being spiritually attacked through technology. The devil has a nice, we know he's taken over printers. Like, I don't know if we'll ever get printers back, but he's getting into everything else too, and you just gotta pray. So if you could pray for me, I would appreciate that the work that I do really requires there be no ghosts or demons in the machines, that all this technology, recording devices, microphones, computers, the Holy Spirit will protect it. I would appreciate that. But without further ado then, here is my conversation with Alex O'Connor on the question of what can we kill?
Trent has a career and history of talking about Catholicism. I have a history and career of talking about atheism. But also, on the side of that, we also talk about ethical issues. For myself, as my viewers will know, I've kind of taken a bit of a turn to talking about animal ethics and veganism in particular. Trent also delves into ethics as well from a kind of Catholic perspective, but I imagine you also like to discuss ethics with secularists without having to assume a Catholic basis.
Oh, certainly. There are Catholics that have some ethical views I disagree with, and there are secular people who I agree with a lot of their ethical views. So ever since I started studying philosophy, ethics is probably the most interesting field to me of all the different fields of philosophy. And I think for most regular people, like, they might have a hard time wrapping their heads around metaphysics, but ethics is something people can jump in very quickly because it's something we do every day. We make ethical choices.
Mm. So I think one of the most kind of pressing ethical questions and the context under which we decided to have this discussion was the subject of what can we kill? This was, we decided we wanted to do some kind of podcast or episode together, and Trent suggested that we do an episode called What Can We Kill? Because so much of ethics surrounds that particular question when it comes to issues of animal exploitation. It's about, in many instances, it's about killing them.
Well, I think, yeah, when we talk about different actions that are morally relevant, I think the question of creating life and ending life, I think nearly everyone agrees that these are very morally relevant considerations, however you define what life is. And now, there's still morally relevant situations where you might destroy a non-living thing. You know, I think that there can be, I know in the Southwest there are these magnificent stones that have formed over millions of years and a bunch of vandals just knocked them over. You know, I wouldn't call that killing, but I think that's morally relevant to destroy a natural feature like that. But the question, though, about killing, I think that informs so many of our discussions about applied ethics, animal ethics, veganism, also among human beings, war, capital punishment, assisted suicide, the big thing that we're debating right now in the United States about abortion. Many people talk about abortion as if this is just an issue related to women's rights. Well, really, abortion is an ethical question about killing. Every honest person involved in the abortion debate concedes that abortion ends the life of a developing living thing. So when you do that, whether it's an animal or a human, we have to pose serious ethical questions.
Yes, and it seems to me a complicated one. I'm often asked, on the basis of veganism, what my views are on abortion, with a kind of implication that, from the people who ask at least, that because somebody's a vegan, they ought to be pro-life, because the vegan argument often runs a kind of, there's an argument called the name the trait argument, which you've probably come across, where somebody will ask, well, what is it about a pig or a cow or a chicken that's relevantly different to a human being? So what does a pig have or lack that if a human being were to have or lack, you'd be okay with killing that human being in a gas chamber to eat its flesh? Mm-hmm. And then people have pointed out this is much the same as an argument used by a pro-lifer comparing not a human and a non-human, but a fully developed human and mm-hmm. a fetus in the womb. They'll right. say, well, what's true of the fetus? Is it because it's unconscious? Is it because it's not viable? Is it these kinds of things? Well, if you had a fully grown human being who was unconscious, could you kill them? And people see them as kind of a similar ethical question, which, of course, I understand from that perspective. But I think the real strength of the vegan argument and why there's a disanalogy here mm-hmm. is that, especially when it comes to something like factory farming,
right.
and especially when we're talking about people who are eating animal products because they like the way they taste, which is the vast majority of cases, even if people say they're doing it for health reasons, so long as you could get the same nutritional benefits mm-hmm. elsewhere,
right.
the only thing that you can only get from the animal product is the way it tastes.
Right.
So we're kind of doing it for taste here. And for that reason, with the vegan discussion, what we have is a situation where people are taking their most trivial interest, that is taste pleasure, and raising it above the most basic and fundamental interests of these animals. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, in the abortion discussion, if we are indeed dealing with a morally considerable being here, mm-hmm. comparable to a human being, then I think it would be analogous in the sense that we're upsetting a basic fundamental right of a fetus, that is the right to life.
Right.
But it's not comparable in terms of the triviality of the reasons that are being given for ending that life. With mm-hmm. veganism, it's like, I like the way it tastes, whereas at least in the mind of a pro-choicer, you can certainly understand that it's a lot more of a serious issue. Even if you speak to somebody who eats animals for taste,
sure.
they will themselves admit that it's a fairly trivial reason that they're doing it. But for the pro-choicer, it's not.
I think I would push back a little bit on that, because I think many people would say that their desire to eat meat, yeah, they enjoy the taste of meat and the consuming meat or animal products. But I think many other people would say that it would be incredibly burdensome to live a life or raise a family without the ability to buy animal products, because most people's diet throughout the world is sustained by animal products. In fact, I think that's one question that gets raised in ethics of veganism: is global population sustainable on vegan diets alone? And you know, so I do think it does raise some hefty questions. But interestingly enough, I'm not a big fan of saying, oh, well, if you're vegan, then you should definitely be pro-life. Because the name the trait argument is interesting. It reminds me of that quote from, I want to say it was Jeremy Bentham, who said, it's not whether they can talk or whether they can reason, but whether they can suffer. Mm-hmm. Is essentially the 19th century animal rights activist, you know, credo. You know, the question is not, you know, because the argument is, well, we can kill them because they can't talk or reason. And they said, well, that's not the important point. The point is they can suffer just like you or I can suffer.
Yeah.
And so that should be the issue. And so if the goal of veganism, which is a little bit different than the ethic of killing, which I will return to here shortly, is just to not inflict suffering, then the vast majority of abortions would not fall under that scope, because most abortions take place prior to when a fetus has developed the ability to feel pain. Mm. So if your ethic related to killing is restricted to preventing suffering, then I could see how veganism would naturally follow and the pro-life position on abortion would not. But I personally, like for my ethic when it relates to killing, it's not connected to the question of reducing suffering. Rather, I think there are different reasons to explain the wrongness of killing.
Yes, because of course, a lot of animal rights activists, at least self-described animal rights activists, are not really rights activists, because they come at the question from a consequentialist background. Mm-hmm. They don't really...
Someone like Peter Singer.
Yeah, so Peter Singer will often be described as, like, you know, the father of the animal rights movement. And in a kind of shorthand, he is. You can describe him as such, and he certainly influenced
it's
a lot
more,
of
animal rights.
Yeah,
it's more proper to call it the animal liberation movement.
Yeah, animal liberation, maybe animal welfare, but that term has become a little bit more specified in the discussion. It's an animal welfareist is seen as someone who kind of advocates for better conditions for farm animals rather than the abolition of farms.
Right. But
you're right, like the question of suffering is often kind of confused for the question of killing. So the question of killing is often confused with the question of suffering. By the way, I don't know if we're in a hotel room. We're on location.
It's
so
wonderful.
There are noises all over the place. The aircon's going off. There's someone outside smoking in his van with the engine going. So, you know, I don't know if you guys can hear this, but hopefully we're still coming through nice and clear. But You're right. I mean, this is why it's quite a tricky discussion when somebody says, I'm a vegan on the basis of reducing animal suffering.
Right.
And then somebody says, well, what if you kill an animal painlessly? What if you raise an animal in perfect conditions and kill that animal painlessly? Is that wrong? And a lot of vegans will say, yes, I still think that's wrong. And they'll say, well, because, you know, you wouldn't do it to a human. You wouldn't raise and kill a human being. And then I'm thinking to myself, But
that's so interesting, because one of the most common reasons that we euthanize animals is because they've reached a state where they're very sick and they're dying, and they're killed precisely to reduce their suffering. I mean, what would vegans think if you had just like a really sick cat or dog?
Oh, I think in most cases that would be fine. But indeed, they'd be consistent with human beings there. A lot of vegans will be very pro-euthanasia. I myself am certainly pro-euthanasia, at least in some circumstances. Mm-hmm. I think if you can't imagine a situation in which euthanasia is appropriate, I think it's just for want of imagination. I would presume as a Catholic that you're probably against euthanasia in most cases.
Because ultimately, I think that when we approach the question, can I kill this? I think it's very dangerous to approach the question that the standard is just, does it make me feel uncomfortable to do it or not? I really think such an important question, can I kill this, should really be approached with a principled position. Mm-hmm. Like, here is the framework and rules that I follow for what can be killed and what can't be killed.
Sure.
So when it comes to human beings, my position is definitely that we should not directly kill innocent human beings. So, and I lean towards a view that we should never directly kill human beings at all. So that would also include being opposed to capital punishment. But my view would allow for killing human beings in an indirect way. So, for example, if someone was trying to kill us and I shot them in the chest, my goal here is just to stop them, their fatal attack. So so I would be relieved if when the police came, they put them on a gurney and they're alive. Like, I'd be, oh, I'm glad I didn't have to kill that guy. But then I wouldn't obviously be justifying walking up and shooting him when he's no danger.
Yes.
So my position, based on the wrongness of killing, there's probably different reasons. A lot of it deals with a deprivation account, that killing is wrong because it's a form of theft. It takes away something very valuable from human beings, a future of experiences like ours. That's not the whole reason, but that's the philosopher Don Marquis has posed it. And I think it gets a lot right. But also, I think just that human life in and of itself is intrinsically valuable and is just kind of a basic good we ought not act against. So from that, I'll take the position that while animals we can kill under many different circumstances, but we shouldn't do it in a cruel or sadistic way, humans we ought not directly kill. So you're right, when it comes to something like euthanasia or assisted suicide, I would not be in favor of that. I am okay with, if someone is in tremendous pain, to administer pain medication, even if it indirectly shortens their life. But my concern with something like euthanasia, one of my big concerns, and one argument I have against it, would be a difficulty in drawing the line. Because normally, when someone is suicidal, if we consider them to be healthy, let's say they have clinical depression, we try to help them out of that situation. But then we say, oh, well, this person is suffering tremendously. What can we do to ease their pain? I worry if we say, well, what about someone with bone cancer who has 6 months left to live? Surely they're really suffering. They don't have much life left anyways. There's not really a principled place to stop it going back. Like, what about the quadriplegic who might have 50 years of being immobilized in a wheelchair? And then you see where that's where on that particular issue I get concerned.
I take a slightly more liberal view of this, that I agree that it's difficult to draw the line, but in most cases, if somebody is of sound mind and serious about wanting to end their life,
right,
I have a feeling that this might be something that's entailed by the right to life. I mean, presumably you think that human beings have a right to life.
Yes.
But to say, imagine you were to say to somebody that you have a right to freedom of speech, but you have to say something. That freedom of speech seems to require and entail the freedom to not say anything. If you have a freedom to speak, that should include a freedom to stop speaking. And so if you do have a right to life, surely that seems to entail a right to not live at the same time. Otherwise, you don't really have a right to life. You have something like a duty to life. There are some accounts of rights. Well, there are different accounts of what rights are. It's a tricky thing to pin down, of course. But one idea is that that was made famous by H.L.A. Hart was the idea that rights are essentially duties that another person has the ability to choose whether to enact them or not.
Right.
And that if a person doesn't have that choice, then it's not really a right. It's more like a duty that somebody else has that doesn't have a kind of correlative right, because, you know, if you kind of owe me something, but I'm not even able to refuse it, it feels a bit weird to say that I have a right to that thing. It feels like I kind of have a duty to take it. And so I think if you have a right to life, you should have a right, at least in some circumstances, to end that life.
Yeah, and so the comparison there with the right to speech, one I would consider more of a second order political right, and another kind of more of a basic fundamental right, or what might be called an inalienable right, something that cannot be divorced from you, even from oneself. So I agree, like, I believe I'm a very firm advocate of freedom of speech. That's why I really appreciate in the United States having that, to have robust discourse. So much so that I think it's fine for someone, freedom of speech would allow someone to advocate for overturning the First Amendment and getting rid of freedom of speech. It would be entailed in that. But I do think there are other rights where it would not imply that you could even give them up because they're so basic. For example, I believe people have the right to be free, the right to not be enslaved.
Yes.
And so that is such a fundamental right, a person should be restricted from choosing to enslave themselves to someone. You know, let's say we were talking last night about how in the UK, it's a lot easier to deal with your student loans than here. Mm. You know, what if you found some rich person, they said, I'll pay off your student loans if you're my slave for a year. It's like, well, I'm not going to let you. Some people might even take that up. Some people might even want to take up. And I can think of other situations where people would sell themselves into slavery if they were destitute. And,
yes.
But even if you might want to do that, I would say, no, the right to freedom is so fundamental. There are even some things you should be restricted from.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting thing about the concept of an inalienable right, is that a lot of people interpret inalienable to mean something like, well, this is something that nobody can take away from me. Mm-hmm. But an inalienable right is often, I think, supposed to be interpreted, as you say, as something that it's actually impossible to take away from a person. It's not like you don't have the right to do this. It's like, I can't even do this to myself. That's what it means to be inalienable. But of course, I don't really believe that there are such things as inalienable rights. I don't think rights are anything more than a concept that human beings have invented. I think saying that you have a right to life is like saying the gun is always loaded. It's not, but we'll do a lot better if we all just act as though it is. We're kind of, it's something like pretending. But it's more like developing a principle. That I mean, the idea of having a principle, certainly from a secular perspective, is generally just going to be some form of like rule utilitarianism or something, where we say that here's a case where breaking the rule does actually seem to be the best thing to do, but overall, in a kind of societal, what's the word?
Framework or.
Looking for a resolution, in a societal resolution, it's best to stick with the rules, generally speaking. And so you have things like rights, which are basically these concepts. It's not quite pretending. It's not quite like making it up.
Well, it's more like social contract.
Yeah, but it's not real. It's not tangible in the way that maybe you would think that a right is.
Yeah, and I would say rights can be cashed out in different ways. In one sense, they can just be descriptive language to talk about more fundamental moral duties that we have to one another and to ourselves that do exist in an objective way. Although I do think rights, when we talk about rights kind of language, I think it flows from what might be called natural law. Mm-hmm. And there's a rich tradition in the Western world of this idea that there is a fundamental way that rational creatures ought to participate in the world and with each other, and that's natural law. So Martin Luther King Jr., for example, he said an unjust law is a law that is not in accord with the natural law, though he grounded that ultimately in religion, the law of God.
Yes.
But his arguments were still, you know, secular against racial segregation and things like that. But I am curious, and so my ethic of killing would be extremely, extremely limited. I have a very hard and fast rule for humans. And then for animals, it's much, much wider latitude for killing animals that in general, it's permissible rather than impermissible. In the cases where I'd be killing an animal would be very rare for me, where it's morally impermissible. What would your framework be if someone said, well Alex, like, what are the rules for killing? Like, when is killing okay and when is it not okay?
Well, this is something I'm kind of trying to work through. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not entirely sure, but
sure.
I do think it's useful to have a kind of qualified right to life as a concept for human beings. Mm-hmm. I've made a video in the past about why I don't think it's feasible to apply a similar right to life to non-human animals, because I think that human beings essentially, we have a right to put ourselves first. I don't mean as a species, I mean as individuals. I think in a situation where there are multiple people who need to compete for the only food source or something, I think you have a right to allow those other people to starve, for instance. Whether you're allowed to kill them in that circumstance is maybe a little bit more complicated.
Hunger Games.
I'm not sure, yeah. But but for the problem with animal death is that animals are killed in the production of crops, of course. Mm-hmm. It's just that more of them are killed in the production of crops for livestock, and then you kill the livestock. So we choose mm-hmm. to eat the crops because we want to reduce the amount of suffering and death. Mm-hmm. And again, I'd stress that really it's about suffering for me when it comes to veganism, not the death. I'm not,
right,
at least in principle, against killing an animal.
Because we were talking about this the other night, and I'm very sympathetic to the strongest argument for veganism, in my opinion, would be not cooperating with the evil of factory farming.
Now, I find it really interesting because a lot of people say this to me. They say, look, I'm okay with kind of killing an animal. And you were talking about how you have a family friend who,
yes,
who has a farm, and that's where you get your meat from. And mm-hmm. you're an exception in that case, in that...
Unfortunately, not all our meat, but a significant portion of it,
but this
yes.
is what I was going to say. It's like people say that they're sympathetic to the idea. I sat in a hotel room a few years ago with Matt Dillahunty in Texas, in fact, as well. Mm-hmm. And I was saying to him, like, look, don't you think factory farming is terrible? And he said something basically the same as you, which is that I don't think it's wrong to kill an animal in principle, but factory farming is wrong. And I said to him, but then, like, you know, does that, like, why would you then be funding factory farming? And amazingly, he then said, well, who says I do? And I said, like, Matt, we went out for dinner
when
last
you,
night.
When you
like,
eat,
I,
yeah.
I, like, I know that you did. And I kind of wanted to ask the same question to you, which is you say
right.
something like, look, I mean, you described factory farming as an evil. You said that you're mm-hmm. at least sympathetic to the idea we shouldn't be cooperating with it. But, mm-hmm. you know, we go out for dinner last night and, mm-hmm. and there's a vegan burger at the restaurant we went to,
right.
which you didn't opt to have. Now, of course, mm-hmm. it's one question to talk about, like, getting meat from your family friend and,
right.
and this kind of thing. But in that restaurant, mm-hmm. we're paying for factory farm food or we're not. And in that situation,
right.
you choose to do so. And I wonder... do you have like a reason for this? Is this mm-hmm. is this like something that you kind of morally consider, or is it just something you kind of do without thinking about it?
Well, it's something that I've given thought to, but I haven't reached a firm conclusion on. My understanding, how I look at things, is that in the world, things like consumer choices that we make will involve a lot of different kinds of cooperation with evil in a variety of ways. So. Buying a cell phone, for example, will involve rare earth minerals that are mined to create it by children enslaved in Africa, or people who are enslaved in China and Uyghur exploitation there. So there's a lot of different other elements. When you look at questions of things like cooperation with evil, you have to take into account things like the distance from the evil,
that's right.
Whether the evil will continue with or without your support, a proportionate reason to engage in the evil. So I've thought about this for some issues, and I haven't reached a full resolution yet when it comes to factory farming.
But
so
given the ease with which we can eat vegan alternatives when you go to a supermarket or when you go out to a restaurant or something, mm-hmm. doesn't it seem like the burden should be on the other side? That is, mm-hmm. it shouldn't be a case of, I mean, imagine if I were kind of like paying for somebody to torture a dog or something. And you said, look, you should probably stop doing that. And I said, well, you know, I've considered the argument and I think you might be right, but I'm not really convinced yet. So I'm going to keep paying this guy to torture this dog. I'm a little bit further down the supply chain. I'm not the one torturing the dog. Haven't really thought too deeply about it. And I keep doing that. And then I say, but you know, if you can talk me out of it, then I'll stop. Shouldn't it be the other way around, which is I'm not going to pay this person to torture a dog until I can establish that it's ethically permissible to do so. Like, shouldn't it be that we refrain from participating in this industry of horrific cruelty until we're convinced that it's ethical to do so, not the other way around?
Well, I think that that is, I see the argument where you're coming from, and it's similar to an argument that I sometimes make to those who consider abortion, to say that if you are morally repelled by this, or you find it seriously problematic, don't you think then you ought to refrain from doing things that would support it? So, yeah, I see where you're coming from, but also I would like to do, I have not had the opportunity yet to do as in-depth a philosophical analysis as I would want on the question, because there are other issues like related to the question of the overall quality of life, the question of harming individuals that might not have existed anyways if the farming had not happened in the first place.
Yes.
So so that those are things that, that I want to consider. But also I think it is important just for ethical individuals in general. I think it's important for us to understand our bandwidth and that we have a limited amount of, what's the word I should put here, even personal resources that we could use to do good. Because one could take this kind of argument, because choosing to adopt a vegan lifestyle does exact significant costs on a person. And the more costs you add on someone in an already stress-filled life has to be considered. Like to continue you know, with the argument, you could take Peter Singer's argument about the child drowning in the pond. You know, if a child was drowning in a pond and you were, we were worried about ruining our slacks, well, that would be monstrous that we wouldn't rescue that child and, you know, buy a new pair of slacks. And yet we could send $100 to Oxfam today and keep a child from dying. So you see, like, the idea that when we try to live the ethical life, it's possible that it it could collapse so many burdens on us, it's not even feasible.
Yeah, but there's a difference here. I mean, like with the drowning child thing, I've made a whole video on this before. Firstly, there's a, there seems to be a difference here between doing and allowing. There seems to be a distinction between me, when I kind of have a choice, that the situation of buying factory farm products or not seems more analogous to a situation in which you're kind of either paying for a child to be, you know, drowned in a pond, or you're paying for a child not to be, and you have to pick one of them. To pick the child drowning would be immoral. Maybe not saving the child is immoral too, but it seems immoral in a different way or less so. Also, the analogy has been criticized for not being properly analogous, because the reason why there's a demanding this objection to the conclusion of the drowning child is because there are endless drowning children. So there was, I can't remember his name, I talked about him in the video that I made. He wrote a paper about why it's sometimes okay to let the child drown. He imagined this ocean of drowning children, and somebody's hacked into your bank account and they're taking out, say, like, you know, $50 every 5 minutes or something. And when it gets to zero, they're going to still keep taking money, and then the bank's going to start repossessing your your things. They'll take your TV, and eventually they'll take your home.
Oh, they're taking the money to donate to the children. Is that what you're saying?
No, the bank, some hacker is just taking your money, and the bank can't do anything about it. So you're just losing money every 5 minutes. And if you keep losing money, if you go into the minus, the bank's just going to start taking your possessions away. So you're going to start just losing. So you, so the good news is you can go to the bank. It takes about 5 minutes to get to the bank, and you just tell them, and the whole thing stops. But on your way to the bank, you come across this ocean of drowning children in some huge pond, and you can, it's, it takes 5 minutes to go in and save one of them. So you can stop for a minute, and let's say that for some reason there's like a door that you go through, you can't come back. Like you, you've only got this one chance here on the way to the bank to save them. And so it's like, okay, you can, it would be probably wrong to just run past not saving any children. So maybe you stop and you save one child, and in that time you've lost $50. And then you stop and save another child, and that time you've lost $100, and maybe three and four. But then you've lost $1,000, and then you've lost $5,000, and then you've got no money left. And then the bank is now like taking your possessions away. They've taken your TV, and now they're taking your home, and now they're taking your car. in this situation, I think it's ethically permissible for a person at some point, although you should save some children,
right,
to be like, look, I'm sorry, I need to go to the bank now. And that seems like a more analogous situation to the charity situation.
I don't mean to laugh. It's just there is a common hazard sometimes in philosophy when we create thought experiments to help us understand what we ought to do in certain situations, that they can start to get just a bit unwieldy if they're not familiar to us. But also, I think another thing that I will factor in is the larger aspect of applying factory farming, its role in promoting human welfare, because I do believe that animals and humans have different moral worth, and that their suffering is not on a par, and that humans have a different moral status. So I would like to go back though to the main discussion,
yes,
of just killing itself, because I think you would be in favor of killing and eating animals if it were done humane's a weird word to use, but an ethical way.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I'm not sure about. My intuitions seem to scream at me that it would be okay if you, especially considering kind of like the non-identity problem and saying that you have an animal that otherwise wouldn't have lived, that you've brought into existence, you've given a perfectly natural, nice life, and then killed it painlessly to eat it. Like, is this a moral travesty? It might be wrong, but I think if it is wrong, it's far more trivially wrong than is something like factory farming. So it might still be wrong, but it certainly wouldn't be like the forefront of my campaign.
Right.
I wouldn't be like advocating about it.
Well, yeah, and to me it seems, I find it to be obvious, especially in the case of like the cows that we eat where I don't have moral concerns, that they have a good life, killed painlessly, even if they suffered some pain in dying, overall, they had a very good life. And the non-identity problem factors in. The choice would not be that they could have just had this, you know, fun little life in the pasture and then died of old age, although that's a romantic way of describing things. If anything, sometimes dying of old age for animals would be worse than being killed for slaughter. Mm. If you think about the pain going on.
This is true.
Cancer and things like that. Like, we have a romantic thought of the cow just lies down and goes to sleep forever. That's not really how it works.
Mm.
But if they just... So there, then they wouldn't have already existed. I would say that it makes perfect sense. However, I don't believe we would be justified in doing the same thing like with human beings. And I think you made an interesting interesting description in saying, well, I recognize that we should at least, to have a workable society, posit something we call a right to life for human beings that we do not apply to animals. Now, I think, though, a rejoinder to that from even people who agree with you on veganism would say, well, you know, Alex, isn't that kind of speciesist to do that?
Mm. Well, speciesism, I think, is a bit of a misused term.
Mm-hmm.
They imagine that speciesism is something like treating beings differently, sort of, because it's like, I guess, okay, technically speciesism would be something like treating an individual differently on the basis of species alone.
Now, to me, to put my cards on the table, I'm a big critic of this charge. I'm just saying that people will level it.
They will, but of course, speciesism needs to be understood as like, if you're differing your moral consideration of a being just based on species, that is, just because it is a member of a different species, then this is completely arbitrary. But of course, there are things about being another species that entail certain morally relevant properties, right? So like, other animals might not have the same sociability as human beings. They might not have the same capacity for reason. They might not have the same understanding of their own mortality. These kind of things, which these might be good reasons to treat them differently morally. But then you're not treating them differently because they're a cow. You're treating them differently because they have these lack of qualities. And they have those because they're a cow. But it's not because they're a cow that you're treating them differently, if you see what I'm saying. Now, people will criticize me because I use the name the trait argument to say, I say, what trait is relevant to forcing this animal to a gas chamber? And we say, like, well, what if it's like irrational? What if it's like non-sociable? What about this kind of stuff? But of course, in the context of that discussion, I'm saying, what kind of trait would have to be true like, what is it about this animal that allows you to basically do whatever you like to it, to torture it in a factory farm and force it into a gas chamber?
Right.
That's not to say these aren't, like, morally relevant at all. It's just to say they're not morally relevant to factory farming. So if we're on a desert island and you were forced to choose between killing, you know, like a young, healthy, promising cancer research medic, or like an elderly, frail, depressed person who had like a week left to live, I don't know who you would choose to kill.
What is the situation necessitating for killing? Like to get food or like?
It just, I'm not sure. Maybe someone's, it's going to be difficult with you because even if someone's about to blow up the entire world, if you don't kill one of them, you probably would just, I don't know, maybe you'd let them blow up the world because you're a Catholic.
Well, no, I mean, I think there are even, I think even Kant would be someone who would say, let them blow up the whole world.
Yeah, that's true. But.
So, I mean, it is, whatever you take, whenever you rely on a principled framework to, I guess here's the situation with ethics. When you rely on a principled framework to inform what your decision will be, it will always lead you to an uncomfortable conclusion.
Yes.
If you rely, however, on just whatever feels most comfortable to you, that won't happen, but your framework will be totally arbitrary.
Yeah, you're not going to have a principle.
So then it's kind of the choice between, do you want to have comfortable, arbitrary conclusions or principle conclusions that in some cases may be uncomfortable. I prefer that as the latter.
And that makes sense as a Catholic, right? My viewers will probably know that I've most recently been describing myself as an emotivist about ethics. We've been talking a little bit about emotivism. And of course, if you are an emotivist, then ethics essentially breaks down into arbitrary emotions, into feelings.
So that's important then for your ethics of killing, like whether killing is right or wrong. When you make statements like killing this person or killing this animal is right or wrong, you're not expressing a proposition that is objectively true. You're expressing essentially a personal emotion related to the situation at hand.
Yeah, that's right. But then, of course, I don't really... You have to translate what comes out of any person's mouth ethically, depending on their ethical theory.
Right.
So when a utilitarian says, this is wrong, you have to, in your head, translate that, because what they mean is this, you know, causes suffering or this minimizes pleasure or something. That's actually what they mean, but they say this is wrong. If a utilitarian says
this is
wrong...
Right, well, most people, when they say something is wrong, that means... one ought not do it.
Yes.
And then people will have different reasons for why one ought not do it.
Of course, this will need to be translated too, because for a Catholic, saying you ought not do something might mean something like, well, I don't know how you'd exactly kind of cash out the term ought.
Well, ought here would have, it would be a statement of imperative or commanding force that a rational creature is obliged to assent to.
I think, yeah, because you put the word obliged in there, which kind of functions the same as ought. It makes it difficult to define.
With some basic concepts, it's going to be difficult, the most basic things, to define them without using a similar term. It would have imperative force to it.
There are, of course, like non-moral imperatives or non-moral oughts, let's say. Kind of people use the term ought in a non-moral context.
I would say, like in ethics, we can distinguish between a hypothetical imperative and a categorical.
Yeah, of course. And so for me, I think basically as an emotivist, when you say ought, you're always talking about a hypothetical imperative.
Well, for people who might not know the distinction, so like a hypothetical imperative would be, if you want your car to run well, you ought to change the oil. I don't have a moral duty to change the oil, but if I have a goal, my car keeps running, I ought to change the oil. If you want to be healthy, you ought to exercise. You know, Joe's out there running around on the treadmill, being good, exercising. But it's not necessarily a moral thing. But then I think there are other categorical imperatives. Things like, you ought to do good and avoid evil. You ought not torture people. That are more, they're these blanket prescriptions that are fascinating.
I'll push back on your analysis of the distinction there, in that I think there can be, like, hypothetical imperatives are not always non-moral. In fact, a lot of people's consideration of ethics will break down to hypothetical imperatives. So, like, a utilitarian might say, kind of, if you want to maximize pleasure, then you ought to...
If you want to help children, you ought to become a teacher. Yeah, but it doesn't mean you're obliged to do that.
This seems to be a kind of it exists within a moral universe and it's still a hypothetical imperative. The point of having a categorical imperative and the reason that there's usually thought to be like one at the basis of some ethical theory is because this is the categorical imperative from which other hypothetical imperatives are built. It becomes the if.
Right, like the most, one of the most basic ones in natural law theories and others would be you ought to do good and avoid evil.
Yes.
Like that's like just a fundamental one.
Yeah, so that there's, it's an important distinction. A categorical imperative is something that just is an ought that just exists of its own accord. A hypothetical imperative is a kind of if-then statement,
right.
But it can still be a moral if-then.
Right.
But for someone like the for like an emotivist, you would need to translate this kind of stuff as it comes out of their mouth. So you need to understand murder is wrong as something like an expression of boo murder, crudely, as A.J. Ayer had it. You ought not murder might translate to something like don't murder. These things are just expressions. They don't have truth value. Mm-hmm. But this is why when I've made an argument for veganism, as I've said a few times, I don't make an argument from some meta-ethical foundation, but rather consistency on the part of the person I'm talking to.
I guess what's hard for me with emotivism is that it seems that in ethical discourse, we really believe other people are mistaken about moral facts. Like even in the discussion you and I are having, I get the distinct sense that you believe I'm sincerely mistaken in how I'm operating in relation to factory farming and eating, and that I'm wrong. I ought to change.
But
it's because it's not as much like you have a favorite television show or sports team, and I should like it too because it's great. It's not like that's kind of an emotional. Why don't I have the same emotional preference you do? It's like that I've gotten something wrong, almost even mathematically, and I need to see my error and change that.
Well, you're right. That's why, like, what is it that I think that you're wrong about? It probably isn't anything like moral. I mean, I could, maybe there's kind of a separate discussion that we can have about whether I think your ethical theory is correct.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with something like factory farming, if you're happily kind of paying for this kind of stuff, then you're potentially sort of wrong descriptively rather than morally. So you have like a moral baseline that you say that you ascribe to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying that you're kind of maybe acting inconsistently with it. Imagine, for example, that you said, I really like to watch all sports. Like, mm-hmm. I just love watching absolutely any sport that's on the TV. Whenever it comes
right.
on, I just really like it. And I said, well, hey, the football's on. Do you want to watch the football? And you're like, no, I don't like watching football. I'd be like, well, I feel like you just contradicted yourself there. But I'm not, the contradiction and the criticism and the thing you're kind of wrong about here is nothing about the desire. It's not about the kind of basic
desire. I see what you're
part.
Saying.
There's
that
a kind of consistency problem.
Your ethical statements about my hesitation to fully become vegan, it does seem to me different that you're saying, well, I'm not exhorting some kind of categorical imperative or declaring a moral truth. I'm just uttering a description about an inconsistency in your own moral framework. But I really believe that smuggled in there is like a moral imperative to be consistent. Because one could see, even I might say, you know, I can't stand a certain TV show. And you see me watch it, and you're like, oh, you couldn't stand it. And I'm like, eh. And, you know, you will see there's a difference between oddly inconsistent versus worrying deeply hypocritical.
But, of course, you could also kind of be wrong yourself in that you might sort of think that you like all sports, and then we go to watch the football, and you get bored. And it turns out you were actually just wrong about your own desire. People can be mistaken about the contents of the
game. I'm not wrong. I'm not going to watch two guys kick a ball around for 3 hours and it's, you know, 3-1 and, you know,
I'm glad it's a kick instead of throw.
I know, because I know the football
yeah.
as opposed to, in Spanish, it's football americano is what they call with the.
Well, you know that the word soccer has British origin. It comes from association football, which was kind of the official football league or whatever back in whenever it was formed, and so association became soccer, like from association, and that became an Americanization.
Before we run out of time, I want to get your takes on ethical issues just to see where you're at on them, because I know everyone always asks you, like, what do you think about, well, let's say, what do you think about abortion? You know, and I want to make sure, like, see where you're at, because it seems like we've got a good feeling about your baseline for ethics, your understanding of killing. How would that factor into something like abortion?
Well, I'm not sure. But part of the problem of being an emotivist is that you know, people often say that, look, you can't really talk about abortion unless you're in a position to have one. Mm-hmm. That is, like, you shouldn't basically have an ethical opinion on this if you're not a woman. I think that's mistaken. I think that, of course, you can have opinions on things. But I think I'd be more sympathetic to that mindset than you would as an emotivist, because, mm-hmm. of course, if ethics is about emotive expression,
right,
then it's very difficult to truly understand the emotive expression behind something like, hurrah, pro-choice. That, like, saying that there's an ethical obligation to be pro-choice would translate as a kind of emotional feeling towards the abortion issue, which is something that I will never be able to fully understand.
To give an analogy, like, I'm sure you might believe that certain forms of corporal punishment of children is wrong, and you would express significant disapproval towards that, even though you're not in a position to do that with your own child.
That's right, of course. And so, of course, this is true. So somebody can still have, you know, boos and hurrahs towards fetuses, even if they're never going to carry one. Mm-hmm. But it would still be different in the sense that, like, if we were talking about corporal punishment of children, but in some way that those children were more connected to another kind of human being that I am not, that inflicting or not inflicting the corporal punishment would also have this effect on this other kind of human being that I am not. Of course, you can. Like,
I'll give you an example. I'm sure you would have moral disapproval towards many forms of child labor, though those who advocate for child labor may say, "But we live in a very rural or developing country where we can barely feed ourselves, and we have to send our children out to these extremely difficult." So they could offer a justification and a hardship, and you would still stay in the position. I understand the hardship involved, but one ought not treat children this way.
This is true, but of course, remember that I'm talking about. I'm not saying that it's because it has an extra hardship upon a person that I shouldn't be able to have a view on it. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that as an emotivist, I'm going to struggle to understand the moral proposition that's being put forward, because the emotion they're expressing is one that I'm incapable of feeling. Now,
I see.
You talk about somebody could say, well, look, we're in a situation of poverty. We need to use child labor. At least in principle, I could travel there. I could live with them for a bit, and I could begin to understand what it is like to live in that situation. I'm never going to be able to do that with abortion. Having said that, of course, like, planting that flag there and saying that that's an important consideration that should sort of overhang this entire discussion, especially because people will get upset that you have sort of two men here talking about abortion. But look, this is an ethical issue as well, and it's something that needs to be discussed. And I don't know what I think about it. What I do think is that I think that, for instance, the view that life begins at conception, which I think is your view, or I should say life begins at conception, you know, it's a human being when it's conceived, but whether it's a person, whether it's the kind of life that has moral importance, I think the view that this moral importance begins at conception is about as ridiculous as the view that it doesn't begin until it's birthed. I think it's clearly somewhere in the middle here that whatever it is that we care about in ethics develops, right? Like,
so I guess this pushes the question back, because you have an ethical concern about causing suffering to animals, and that would apply to animals who are definitely not persons, who could still suffer. And because some animal rights activists and others believe that the concept of personhood can be applied to some non-human animals or others.
Yes.
So now you've introduced another term here that makes things more complicated, that there are beings we call persons that have special moral value.
I'm using person quite broadly here. It might be an inappropriate usage of the term. What I mean to say is that there's a difference between something being a human or being alive and it being a thing that has moral worth. So when I said the word person there, I probably should have used a different word. Like, I probably was talking about something like sentience.
Sure.
Which is to me the morally important factor. Mm-hmm. And so in the situation, in the case of animals, I think there are a lot of animals that have this sentience or personhood, if we could use it so broadly. But there are some animals that don't. Like, I'd be fine with doing basically whatever you like to oysters, for example, because they just don't feel. But, and I think that an oyster is significantly more developed and probably worth more morally than a zygote a day after it's been conceived.
Mm-hmm. But how do you reconcile that with what you said earlier, that you can understand things like human rights, but not applying those rights to animals? Why wouldn't we just say there are rights for sentient beings and no rights for non-sentient beings?
Because you'd still run into the problem if you ascribe a kind of equality of rights across all sentient beings, you'd have to starve yourself. I don't think I got to the end of this point, actually, because the reason why I think that is because because animals are killed in crops, if you were to say that animals have a right to life that can't be violated, or sentient creatures, then in the same way that even if I'm really hungry, I can't kill you to like take your food and eat it if you have this right to life. If we say that all sentient creatures have that, then I equally can't go and kill an animal with a pesticide or by destroying their habitat in order to grow crops for me to eat. So the fact that crop production involves the killing of non-human animals that are sentient, if I were to say that all sentient creatures have a right to life, I'd have to starve myself because I wouldn't be able to eat at all because I'd have to do some killing in order to eat. I don't think this is a livable proposition. So when I said earlier that people have a right to put themselves first, I don't mean as a species, I mean like as an individual. So that's where we got derailed, because I was talking about kind of how there are circumstances in which it's okay to like value your own life over the life of another if you're in a situation of necessity. And in the same way, I would think that I have the ability to do that over another sentient creature.
So the argument seems to be one born out of like practicality then when it comes to that. So then we understand there are sentient beings, but it seems to me like we would treat rats, like for example, like a rat and a newborn infant. A rat may be cognitively superior to a newborn infant. They can navigate mazes, they have sense of memory. But it seems like newborn infants, we ascribe them as having more moral worth.
Yes, and I think quite rightly, there are a few reasons for doing this. There's like a psychological explanation, which is that human infants are humans, they're more like us, we're more predisposed to emotively thinking that they're worth more, just as a matter of emotion. So like on the descriptive side, I would use that to explain why people think that.
But that wouldn't justify.
Of course, is there a justification? Well, I think that there's an interesting question to be had here. When we say that a rat is cognitively superior, it might have kind of, as you said, I can't remember what examples you
like were navigating there, like, a maze.
Yeah, like better navigation, this kind of thing. But for instance, can a rat abstract?
No, but neither can an infant.
I think maybe an infant can. This is potentially one of the things that distinguishes the human mind, and it's one of the things that a lot of people have used to try to.
I find that a very dubious proposition about a newborn infant. Most psychological tests to determine things like self-consciousness are things like the mirror test, whether you can identify a dot on you, that's you in the mirror. No, children can't pass that test till they're many months old. But there are birds that can even pass that test.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't know, but again, that's not quite the same thing as abstracting, because if you look at, there are some neo-Cartesian views of animal suffering. Of course, the original Cartesian view is just that animals don't suffer, which is not...
Yeah, I find that impossible.
It's not really taken super seriously, but there are, as you well know, I think we were talking about them in our conversation with Cameron and Joe.
Right.
There are views that non-humans don't have a kind of perception through time in the way that human beings do. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if that's the case. It seems at least plausible. But if it is true that a rat has kind of... that the neo-Cartesian is right about the mind of a rat, that it experiences pain but doesn't have a consciousness through time, so it doesn't really experience suffering over time.
I think they have done experiments with rats where, like, pushing certain levers, you know, will exhibit treats and they remember that. I picked rats because I could pick, like, I think a dog, you know, dogs.
Yeah, dogs.
But the problem is, some people will say dogs and infants have the same moral worth. And I don't know if they really. Yes. I don't know if they really believe that. So I'm trying to pick an example of an animal that's not prejudiced, but takes us away from the fallacy of domestication, essentially. So so for me, when it, let's see, Cameron, we have lots of stuff today. We could talk forever. Yeah, so when it comes to, because it's just interesting that you draw the line at birth. That's why I did a little head thing, like, oh, Because to me, there's not like the important like sentience and these other properties that you find morally relevant. I agree with you. Like if sentience is ultimately what matters, that develops maybe 20 weeks into pregnancy. But there's lots of beings that are just merely sentient and aware of the outside world. Having a perception of self over time doesn't really occur till far after birth. So
I don't know. Like that much about the development of cognition in fetuses, and also really an understanding of the cognitive abilities of different kinds of animals in
right.
a particular context. So like I know about their relative levels of sort of suffering and this kind of thing, but when it comes to like the ability to abstract or conscious experience through
right.
time, this isn't something that I'm aware of. What I want to do is just flag that it's not always quite as simple as saying like, look at this animal that seems to have more neurons firing or can navigate better or something. There are
right.
other factors that are often kind of forgotten about, like the ability to experience through time,
right?
Like the ability to abstract that might be really relevant here.
And I guess for me though, I don't see any on the face of it evidence of that in a newborn infant. I think that their moral worth comes simply because they belong to a particular kind, and so they will develop morally relevant traits later, but the fact they belong to that kind now is why they have their specific moral worth. And so if that were the reason to ascribe them moral worth, I think that would also apply to human fetuses and embryos and belonging to the kind, even if they will only manifest the trait later in the future. So that's where I would look at it.
But of course, this kind of principled view does push you to saying that a fertilized zygote from the moment of conception is a human being with the kinds of rights that a grown human being has.
It does, but I don't think that's problematic because I would say, for example, that I was once a zygote. I was that.
I mean, I would say that I was once kind of scattered around the universe in various areas and in the center of stars and things like this, but...
Oh, I have a different view. I guess we might have a different view. That's a question in mirology, the study of the parts. And I consider that a very radical view. And it's one of the objections to the view that I've offered is the idea that there can be... I don't believe that their example could be an object that contains the tip of my finger and the Eiffel Tower, even though the two did come into contact at one point when I visited it. So that's a view I would consider very problematic. Rather, I when someone says, "Well, it's problematic that you were once a zygote," no, not at all. Because to say that a zygote is a person, a zygote is a person, or a blastocyst is a person, is problematic. It doesn't seem problematic to me because I once was that. An analogy sometimes I like to use was from the law professor Richard Stith, is a Polaroid picture. Like if you took a Polaroid picture of a very famous thing like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster, and it disappeared. And when the Polaroid comes out, it's just this little smudge. You can't recognize it yet. But if you were to destroy it, the picture would be gone, even if it hadn't developed yet. And so I see that in a view of looking at even embryos, that even if one can't recognize humanity, it's still present there.
But well, of course, humanity is there.
I mean, a person. This is a person.
But like this fertilized egg is far from a person.
Well,
it has none of the qualities.
Right. I would say that fertilized egg is a misnomer because upon fertilization, the egg no longer exists. We have a developing human organism.
Yeah, so call it a zygote. Yeah, I'm just trying to imply that. I'm not talking about like a kind of 24, 25-week developing fetus. I'm talking about like the moment after conception.
Of course.
And I say I don't think this is a person. You seem to imply that you think it is because of some argument along the lines of, well, I'm a person and I was once a zygote.
They're different. I have mounted various arguments for the personhood of the unborn. That is an argument actually is based on an essay from the philosopher Alex Proust, and he actually doesn't use personhood. He just says, it was wrong to kill me then. It's an argument based on personal identity.
Yeah, because if it's wrong to kill me now, if I'm the same thing as I was yesterday, then it's wrong to kill me yesterday for the same reason as killing me now,
right.
if I am the same thing.
Right.
And so it would be wrong to kill me the day before, and you can take it back. If it's the same thing...
If you have the same identity over time.
If you are the same thing as that zygote, it's wrong to kill that zygote
right.
for the same reason. Of course, it's difficult to imagine how somebody would kill me now for the same reason as killing a zygote then. Like, it would have to involve a situation where if you didn't kill me right now, maybe a random woman is forced to undergo pregnancy and the pain of childbirth or something. You'd have to make the situations actually analogous. But even then, it would seem a bit
well,
strange.
Well, I mean, people, it could be wrong to kill someone, even if someone wanted to kill me 10 years ago for a completely different reason.
Mm.
But the personhood element here, I ascribe personhood as belonging to a rational kind, because to me it makes sense as to why a newborn infant is a person, a rat is not, and you and I are persons. The only thing the newborn and you and I share is belonging to that kind, because the newborn does not have the same cognitive faculties. And so for me, if it's belonging to the kind is what makes one a person, logically, I must extend it backwards to any other biological member of the kind.
Do you think that a zygote then, that mm-hmm. is a day after conception,
yeah.
would have more worth than, let's say, a fully grown pig?
Would have more moral worth?
Mm.
Yes.
More moral worth.
Absolutely.
So what is it? And it's just being...
The same that a newborn infant does. Yeah.
It's just being a Homo sapiens mm-hmm. that gives this zygote moral worth.
Well, a smart guy once said it's not necessarily just belonging to a species. It's the fact that members of that species might have certain abilities that are morally relevant, to harken back what you said earlier. But yeah, I do believe that there is a deep-seated intuition that belonging to the human species, you are accorded with a certain intrinsic value. Part of that is related to the fact that humans are capable of doing things non-humans cannot, and that they're morally relevant.
So would you ascribe...
But the value is still given even if you're not capable of exercising those functions yet.
Would you ascribe that to other species of human beings that are now extinct? For instance, Neanderthals, Homo erectus, these kinds of
animals? I would say that it is possible that these... So the question would be, did these other hominids have intrinsic moral worth? And I think it's quite possible that they did. They may have had immortal souls. There's always going to be boundary cases where you're not sure of something, but I don't think that detracts from the clear cases where you are sure.
I did have one more thing I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
And I know we're running
Cameron's
out of time.
Cameron's going to get
here.
So mad.
Cameron's going to be very
sorry,
angry.
Cameron.
Mm-hmm. Presuming you would believe, I'm not sure about this, that human beings share a common ancestor with other animals
mm-hmm.
by natural selection. This is
I do hold that view, yeah.
So the problem that I'm seeing here then is that If you took every evolutionary ancestor, if you imagine the evolutionary tree mm-hmm. that sort of starts at the common ancestor and stretches out, and all of these ancestors in the middle, you just resurrected them just in your mind. So you have this long line of creatures, starting with a Homo sapiens, next to them is a Homo sapiens, next to them is a Homo sapiens, every creature that's ever lived on the planet.
Okay.
You go down along this line, and at some point it's going to start to look a little bit more apish. At some point it's going to start to look a little bit more fish-like until you get all the way back to like a fish and then like a mm-hmm. microbe. The problem I have with saying that human beings just have like a categorical difference in moral treatment is mm-hmm. that on this line of resurrected mm-hmm. evolutionary trajectory, there seems to be no place at which you could non-arbitrarily draw that line. I mean, if you want to say that human beings have moral worth by virtue of being human, such that a human being born 100,000 years ago is worth, it has these rights, has a right to life, even if they weren't recognized in the
but maybe
a
sub-hominid or an ape does not.
Yeah, but of course there's no point at which like a sub-hominid birth to a hominid. That never happened, right? And so on my view that this is a developmental thing, it's like mm-hmm. properties of a human being that give it moral worth, this seems to make perfect sense. This seems to be consistent. But to say that there's something about being a human mm-hmm. requires putting a boundary around human beings, which is easy to do now because other human beings have gone extinct and we're
right.
quite different from our closest ancestors.
Right.
But in principle, if you resurrect the evolutionary hierarchy,
right.
there's nowhere to draw that line.
And I think maybe we'll have to cap our discussion with this, that for me, then this may ultimately go back, that there is no strict biological explanation for why particular hominids have value. It may not be a biological explanation. It may be a theological explanation.
It would have to be, right?
I would say that it has to be. And so for me, that would actually not be a weakness of my position in ethics. I would say that it actually provides evidence for the particular Christian theism that I hold, in that if we're so dead set on this intrinsic human value, if it can only be explained theologically, that to me would give good evidence for God.
That's fascinating.
But you and I will have to chat about that more tonight.
One man's modus ponens being another man's modus tollens, right?
That's right.
Exactly what's going on here. I would say that, you know, since there's kind of nowhere to draw this line non-theologically and the theology is wrong, therefore there's nowhere to draw the line, you would say that since there's nowhere to draw this line non-theologically, but we do need to draw the line, therefore the theology
is correct.
So you would imagine kind of at some point along this evolutionary trajectory, you have something like ensoulment, or you have God breathing life into this sub-hominid ape to make it become an ape, such that you do have you don't so much have a non-hominid giving birth to a hominid.
You would have Homo anatomicus becoming Homo theologicus, essentially.
Yes. And that would occur, presumably you wouldn't imagine like a non-hominid giving birth to a hominid, but rather a non-hominid giving birth to a non-hominid that then has life breathed into it.
Well, there are different, and we had to end on the most controversial thing. Different Christians have proposed different ways of understanding this. It could be that God could choose a large number of Homo anatomicus to become Homo theologicus, or perhaps only a single pair. And, you know, anywho, that's the question of Adam and Eve, monogenous. Mm. Always a rich thing. But yes, I would say how I would look at it, I think it can be turned around to support the Christian worldview.
I think that's fascinating. And it's a shame we have to leave things there. We've gone a bit all over the place.
But it was fun.
But we'll see what people say, and perhaps we can revisit this at some time and go deeper on it.
Well, I'm hoping to do I've never been to the UK yet, so I really want to do a tour there.
Yeah.
So it'd be fun. There's lots of good people to visit and chat with. So
yeah. Well, if you find yourself over across the pond, do let me know, and we'll continue this discussion. But I hope that it's been of use to people listening, even if it has been a little bit kind of surface level in some areas because we haven't been able to dive in deep. But of course, we're going to be talking even more on stage in front of a crowd in like a few hours. And the video will, by this point, be linked down in the description. So do be sure to go and check that out. But with that, I think we should wrap it up. So,
all right.
Brent, thanks for sitting down and having the conversation.
Thank you, sir.
It's been good fun.
It was fun.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.